and welcome to what we think is episode 3 of the new podcast series, in which we examine new ways of doing business, new business models, new technology models for the 21st century under COVID conditions. I'm joined, as ever, by Eric Masaba, who is the founder and CEO of Texi. I'm also joined, as ever, by Rory Sutherland, who is the vice chairman of Ogilvy in the UK. Rory, hello.
I was on mute. Sorry. Hello there. Sorry.
It's a good start to a podcast because Eric waved and you're on mute. This is the new way of doing business. New way of doing broadcasting where everyone waves on the radio. So anyway, so Rory is there. Eric is there. We have a number of other guests. So the last episode, we only had three people. We've got, there's six of us today. We're also joined by Jeffrey Funk. And Jeffrey recently retired, Associate Professor of Technology Management at the University of Singapore. So Jeffrey joins us from 8 hours in the future. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. We've also got Nigel Scott. Nigel is a former Australian Ministry of Defence scientist, and he's an expert in valuation models. Nigel, welcome. And we're also joined from Nigeria by Nandi Odozie. Nandi is an Cambridge-educated engineer and actuary who works in the Nigerian insurance sector. Nandi, thanks for your time and welcome. Nandi's also nodding, so this is good. This is a good way of starting. Nobody is now on mute. This is good. So what we're talking about on this episode, episode 3, or it's actually episode 3A, but we'll talk about it later, is looking at startups. And we're looking at the way of how COVID has affected investment in startups, how startups work, and it's a fascinating way of doing business, as we already know. But how is this going to be affected by the restrictions we're all living under? I am currently in London, where as of today, I'm in tier 2, as is Eric in Liverpool. Rory is in tier 3 in rural Kent. We're about to go into tier 3, apparently. We don't know what's going on. So how the technology sector is suffering, clearly, by no one really knows what's going on. What is the future for technology? What's the future for all of us? We don't know. So, Jeffrey, do you want to start the ball rolling? What is happening? There we go. There's a massive question to start with.
Well, basically, most of these startups are losing money and losing a lot more money than they lost 20 to 50 years ago. So I've looked at profit numbers for 2019 for 73 unicorn startups, and 67 of them didn't have profits. Only 6 had profits. And 70 of those, and when I looked at the ones that produced 2020 figures, only 63 of 70. I mean, I'm only 7 of 70 had profits. So wow. We're looking at it as something far worse than in the past, where 20 to 50 years ago, companies like Microsoft and Google became profitable very, very quickly. All of them, virtually all of the top startups started that were founded since 1970 had profits by year 10. So now we're looking at all these startups that are older than 10 years, yet they're far from being profitable.
Okay. So Nandi, what's the picture like in Nigeria? Let's talk about Nigeria specifically, but I mean, okay. Talk about Africa as a whole, it's an enormous continent, but specifically, what's the picture? Is it the same as in Singapore?
My numbers were for all of, for American startups. Sorry.
Okay, fine. Excellent. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about Nigeria is that a lot of the startups are actually quite concentrated. So you find a lot of them in the payment space. You know, we have players like Paystack. Paystack was recently acquired by Stripe, $200 million, etc. And they mostly payments, gaming, gambling, some now in healthcare. So in those kind of areas, there's still quite a lot of demand. And I would say that they are making money.
They are making money
in those areas, and especially payments. Everything seems to be payments. You know, we've got quite, you know, this is Nigeria, so the valuations aren't as high, you know, but we've got InterSwitch valued at over $1 billion, Paystack, I mentioned, Flutterwave. We've got a few incubator kind of sites where the likes of Facebook and Google and so on come and pour money in. So there is traction, there's movement, you know. I would say that there's movement in those areas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rory, what's your take on it? Because from an Ogilvy point of view, I'm looking at, I suppose, is which startups, or any sector really, but looking at, say, at fintech, which of these startups do you think are going to be like bursting forward, becoming the big players? And because people are looking at investing money into these startups to get them over that sort of that first hurdle. A, is that money there? And B, are the startups ready? And have they been hampered by the restrictions we've been under this year and are likely to be for at least half of next year?
I think it's interesting. I think two things. One of the things I look for, oddly, in a disproportionately successful startup is something faintly nonsensical. Because I think the really interesting thing, it's always worth remembering that even if you have a better solution to something, okay, people have usually found a workaround that, you know, that actually in many cases, what you're doing is you're creating essentially a cure for which there is no known disease. I think we're not skeptical enough about tech in that we tend to look for we tend to do a benefit analysis. Anything that has automation or technology attached to it is assumed to be beneficial, and we don't look at the possible costs. I think, by the way, just as a slight aside, and I've just written about this in The Spectator, I think that actually the invention of email was probably net negative for humanity. Okay, right?
Yeah.
Let's take an older one, the typewriter. Okay, when you think about it, the typewriter was a device that meant that everything in business had to be written twice. Okay, because you didn't look like a serious business if you wrote by hand.
Yeah.
Most people who wrote couldn't type. And so it effectively meant that every single piece of written communication had to go through a barrier. Now, on the other hand, that had advantages in that a barrier to communication, some degree of friction around communication, is not necessarily a bad thing. So oddly, I see Zoom as actually highly positive because it enables synchronous decision-making and discussion rather than asynchronous decision-making and discussion. And asynchronicity is actually the hallmark of a bureaucracy. Two people who are required to ratify a decision, neither of whom are in the same place at the same time, they can both feel individually perfectly productive because they're busy pressing send, reply, it's forward, etc. And they feel they're actually doing something. The experience to the external user of the organization is catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I one of the things I think is undoubtedly a bias is that anything which says we're going to take this thing that used to be done by humans and we're going to automate it gets an automatic thumbs up. And in my book, I call this the doorman delusion, you know, that a management consultancy goes into a hotel, points out they have a doorman, points out that he costs £30,000 a year. They immediately then define the doorman's role as opening the door, replace him with an automatic door opening mechanism, and lay claim to the putative cost savings. But of course, the doorman is performing six or seven other functions around status, recognition, security, taxi hailing. And actually, what you do is you quantify the saving and you bury the cost because it's less measurable. And I think we've done that with tech. But equally, I think tech ideas sometimes uncover things. The most nonsensical tech ideas, in a way, sometimes uncover unspoken and unmet human needs, which are unmet because they're unspoken, because in some cases they're even unthought. And I became a weird discoverer of Gusto, which is the food kit service in the UK, and HelloFresh you may be aware of.
Yep. Okay.
And I have to admit, when the founder said, I'll send you a box, I couldn't see the point of this at all, rationally, because I thought, well, I've got 15 cookbooks at home. I can order the ingredients on a Ocado and make the food. What's clever about this? The magic of it is behavioral, that when you get the precise ingredients delivered, you do end up making the dish. Whereas I've got these 15 cookbooks, I've probably made six of the recipes in all of them. And so, so sometimes tech helps us stumble on something we never knew we cared about. And in those cases, the Uber map is an example. I know Uber is often cited as a massive bubble stock because can you really make money in the taxi business in that way? But nevertheless, the Uber map was a discovery of something fundamental, which is that actually the worst part of booking a taxi probably wasn't the cost. It was the uncertainty over its arrival.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I'm very mixed on it. I mean, it does fascinate me, though, that you could make a list of businesses which would include Apple, which would include Gusto, which would include Five Guys, not all of them tech businesses. But nearly all of them contain an element of seeming absurdity. Okay, which yeah. suggests that maybe they're successful because they've tapped into something we never knew we wanted. And yeah. Yeah. that's the really, I regard the tech industry as actually a process of psychological discovery through tech rather than technological discovery through tech.
Yes.
And what I call it, it's the Galapagos Islands, basically. It's where we can, you know, look at exceptions and oddities and discover things.
It's the Galapagos Islands of tech. Yeah, I like that. Okay, well, Rory mentioned taxi hailing. Eric is the obvious person to follow on from that point. So, I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because you're looking at... I'll use an example. I think I've used an example before. But the city of Madrid put out a request for proposals for technology to help Madrid stay mobile during the first pandemic lockdown. And people were able to send in ideas for technological developments that can enhance mobility and people's access to mobility, where normally this would take maybe 2 or 3 years for something to get, maybe that's a good idea, we can put some money in. Things were happening in weeks. So, again, there is no benefit to a pandemic. I'm not saying there is, but that was an interesting way that startups have actually been able to profit from what's going on, actually, but providing a benefit. So where do you think startups can actually play a part in moving us out of COVID? Because that's the next step. We're talking about the end of COVID. In the UK, we've had the first set of vaccines. The second person to get the vaccine was a man called William Shakespeare from Warwickshire, which was absolutely genius, although true. So we're moving out of it. We see the light in the tunnel.
Did they choose him for that reason, or was it a coincidence?
They must have done, because the first person was Margaret Deenan from Enniskillen,
yeah.
Northern Ireland, and the second person was called William Shakespeare, who was from Warwickshire. I think of all the people all the over 80s in the UK who could have had that vaccine, they chose him. It can't be coincidence, can it?
No, it can't be.
No.
Anyway, we'll talk about William Shakespeare later on. But Eric, what do you think? I'm talking about the tech light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, I've been reading Jeffrey's research for about 6 or 7 years, really detailed stuff, and we've never seen this kind of bubbles in the amount of investment put in. Now, I have to lay claim the whole map thing, 4 years before it even existed, before Travis Kalanick claimed to have invented it, we had a map app on a O2 XDA, and this was in Australia. We found a mining firm in Brisbane, which actually found, if you dug a hole in Australia, because it's the size of a continent, you would never find it again. So you needed a GPS location. And we used that as the basis for our map-based hailing, where you could see the cab coming and whatever else. So I have to lay claim to the complete invention of this.
Yeah.
So what happens is, of course, this was something which people, a lot of people, including a lot of people who then went on to back Uber, couldn't see and said wouldn't work. And they said, this is a pointless, dumb idea. And just as Rory has said, often we don't know what's going to work. And some of the most unlikely and unusual things tend to get picked up and tend to grow exponentially. Instagram apparently was some sort of thing called blurbin or bourbon for making photos of where you were if you were on holiday. And the chap's girlfriend then said, why don't we do this? And it became Instagram. Now, obviously, they had the connections in the VC industry. But what we've seen that we never even saw, even in dot-com boom one, is we're seeing completely loss-making startups with no path to profitability and no viable path to profitability getting 10, 20, 30 billion, not even for IPO, pre-IPO. We're seeing them going to IPO, admitting they have no path to profitability, they haven't made money, they'll never make money, they've got 100% or even worse than 100% losses, because a lot of things are hidden off the books. Mm-hmm. And it's just mind-boggling. Maybe they're planning for the extension into a market like Africa, which have been the leaders in, for example, payment solutions, because Africa went mobile first. So a lot of the payment stuff and a lot of, I think Rory mentioned in our one of our podcasts that the pay-as-you-go cell phone plan came from people wanting to have a spare phone in their car in case their car broke down.
Yeah.
And I think that was started in Africa.
It was also started in South Africa because of credit problems. You couldn't credit check people necessarily. And so it was started through necessity, really. And actually, the majority of revenues for most mobile companies in the UK, I think, come from pay-as-you-go now.
Interesting. So again, I think things which once we have a shakeout, which is what Jeffrey's been talking about, which we're not seeing because of all this Fed liquidity, which is just people picking winners, we would see useful things. Just like you'll figure out, hey, you know, Zoom is pretty useful. Uber can't make money yet, but what if we link it with road pricing and you do get paid to stay off the road? So if you are staying at home to Zoom, you're getting another income from the road. Things like that will then make money. But we have to have a massive pruning. We have to have a forest fire. Sorry, Australians, but you know what I mean? We have to have some sort of shedding of all this unusual biomass in this ecosystem.
Yeah.
I mean, Jeffrey can add more color to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's even worse about these huge amounts of funding is that they're celebrated. A company gets a few more billion and the media celebrates it. Wow, this startup is so great. They're getting all this funding. And no one asks, hey, why does it need funding? It's not really building warehouses or, you know, there's no capital investments. It's all for subsidies. So they're getting more funding because they're losing money. And you have a company, for example, Didi Chuxing, a ride-hailing service in China, the biggest one in China. It's gotten about $25 billion in funding.
Wow.
You know, and Uber has more than $25 billion in cumulative losses. Well, Didi Chuxing probably has similar level of cumulative losses.
There was a story on the BBC earlier this week that it said Uber is to sell its self-driving car arm to focus on making profits. So I thought, well, okay, that's good. That's because it's about time they did, isn't it? Unless I'm being very harsh. They don't appear to have made a penny, have they? Unless I'm a complete idiot.
For years, Uber said that, well, we'll make money once we have all our vehicles driverless.
Yes.
That was the long-term argument. And now, and so you would think that now that they've sold this driverless, this unit for actually less than it used to be valued, that the whole company would, the stock price would collapse because people say, oh, okay, so now that's not going to happen. But it's still going, as you said, it's still going great.
Nigel, let's bring you in. Sorry, you've been on the peripheries because you. Sorry, Nigel. So where do you stand on this argument? Let's focusing on Australia particularly. Now, if you look again, we have to mention COVID and the pandemic. It's has shaped everything of this year. But so we're still in the thralls of the pandemic in the UK. Australia, not so much or not at all. Looking at the footage from the cricket the other day, Australia India game, there was 60,000 people there. Very jealous of that. How's the startup sector being affected in Australia, and how's it helping to come out of it?
The startup sector in Australia really is replicating the Silicon Valley model,
right?
And that obviously doesn't make it unique. There is a worldwide trend towards replicating the way Silicon Valley innovates. I think that the work of Jeffrey suggests in detail that perhaps the Silicon Valley model is highly inefficient and perhaps is uniquely American in its ability to burn significant amount of cash to deliver fairly mediocre results. Right. Certainly if you look at the efficiency of a free market model in the Australian context. Venture capital is fairly immature. It's certainly growing. It's certainly adopting the Silicon Valley model. But at the same time, if you look at the Australian startups which went straight to a stock market listing, things like Afterpay, among many, you will find that those startups which listed within 2 to 3 years of starting have have returned to their investors as good as, if not significantly higher than the returns that US VCs achieve with the likes of Uber and Airbnb and so forth.
Right.
So I think if you actually go through the detail with a fine-tooth comb, and I think you'll see that also in the London markets, in the German markets, in the Japanese market. The reality is that the traditional free market approach, where startups approached an open market to raise funds from multiple investors through the stock exchange, is equally as efficient, if not more so, than the venture capital model, which has emerged since the 1970s.
Okay.
Now, if you take the time to actually look at venture capital returns in the US in detail, you will find that the outsized results, which the industry claims to be its benchmark, in reality only happened during boom-bust phases like the dot-com boom and the one we are seeing today. Again, if you dig a little bit deeper into that data, you'll find that the dot-com era is basically replicated today simply because what's happening is the Fed is pump-priming the market, just as Alan Greenspan did during the dot-com boom by trying to print money to offset the year 2K challenge.
Yeah.
The Fed Reserve today has printed money to offset the COVID challenge. Essentially, the markets have responded in the same way. And equally, VCs have seen that opportunity, and that's why we've had an awful lot of IPOs this year to take advantage of the liquidity in the market. And they're getting top dollar for their product at this point in time.
Yeah.
And, as Eric knows, I ended up building a robo VC.
Yes, I want to talk about that. Let's do that now. Robo.
Yeah, but basically, the background of that model is I was invited by Accenture to go to their fintech lab in Hong Kong.
Right.
This was back in 2017. We took there an insurance tech model. Essentially, we modeled cyber risk after spending some time in New York with the brokers and carriers there. And we discovered that actually the cyber risk was oversold and was actually an ideal opportunity for most businesses to set up a captive insurance model, essentially self-insure. The premium goes into your own insurance company and then you can use those premiums to invest in other things. So it turns a cost center into a profit center. So essentially you went to Hong Kong to say, hey, what we really want to do is turn the cyber risk model into a captive insurance exchange model. The finance institutions there looked at what we were doing and said, you're mad, you should set up a hedge fund. And what came out of that was this robo VC. Now the robo VC basically modeled the top 100 VCs in the US. And it created a behavioral model which took the investment styles of the top VCs and then applied it from everything through from seed through to IPO. Now, the results that came out of that allowed us to go on and produce post-IPO models. But in terms of what we're discussing today, which essentially is the impact of tech in a post-COVID world. A couple of things you need to understand succinctly, and that is venture capital is essentially a narrative. Mm. And the narrative is basically about saying we are the pipeline for innovation in the West.
Yeah.
In reality, venture capital is better understood as a used car dealer. Essentially, the product they're offering is 15 years ago, they bought a brand new Ferrari. They flogged it to death, and the 200% growth, 150% growth, 100% growth, 50% growth. And then 15 years on, they then throw that out into the stock market. And generally speaking, it's achieving about 30% growth. So basically, they've flogged it. The engine's now running at 30% capacity compared to what it was in the first couple of years. But they're asking you to pay a premium for basically a worn-out business model. Not only that, it's leaking money. And essentially, the narrative is broken in terms of the returns for the retail investor post-IPO are just not there. Dot-com era was very different. Potentially, the Yahoos and the eBays and the Amazons were actually coming to the market within 2 to 3 years of being invented. Same with Booking.com or Priceline as it was back then. So what you were doing is you were buying a startup which was in its formative years. So although you were paying a premium, you were looking at growth opportunities which are in excess of 200% per annum. So the revenue growth was sky high. Today, if you look at Priceline when it came to market, it was doing about 250% a year-on-year growth. Tomorrow, Airbnb gets listed, and it's doing about 32%. Okay, so it's a fraction of what Priceline was offering. More importantly, when Priceline was brought to market, the number of people on the internet could be counted in the tens of millions. Today, it's billions. So the market isn't growing. You know, that future market isn't there. Priceline, eBay, Amazon, Google, all of these startups grew with the market that grew, which was internet adoption. Now, that adoption ratio has dropped because in the US, we have over 80% adoption of the internet. Same across Western Europe, same across the Asia Pacific. So that opportunity to grow with the market has disappeared. So essentially what you have now is a generation of tech coming through that actually is late to market. You know,
can I, it was
20 years ago, today it's basically coming up against incumbents. And that's why their cost of customer acquisition is so high. And that's why they're losing money hand over fist.
Yeah. Eric, you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah. What I'm really thinking, because exactly what Nigel just said there, is it's a narrative, okay? This is Rory's Ken, basically, because once you want to get a new technology accepted, you have to create a narrative. You have to say, let's make this thing work. I think it would be really interesting if we could apply Jeffrey's research with Nigel's RoboVC model and a few ideas from Rory to say, okay, here's X candidates. How would these perform if we had a narrative, and how would they compare to some of these companies that we have going right now? Because I think there is incredible scope to say to people, you'd get much better returns if you invest in this thing, which currently doesn't look like it's a good idea. Maybe it could be a new type of transport system using, you know, autonomous pods, for example, which might seem a bit strange 2 years ago, but now with this COVID thing might look quite a good idea. And we could apply some of those models because, as Jeffrey said, there is nothing but just, it's loss making. It's unbelievable. We didn't even see this in the worst excesses of 2001. And also in places like Africa, where you do have that growth, sure, lots of people on mobile devices, but in terms of what they use, I think that micropayment market can expand. I mean, I'd love to hear what you'll think of that, because I do believe that that's going to be the only place you're going to get growth in Africa and South America, ultimately.
Well, just so happens, having Nandi here, who is in Nigeria, let's ask him that question. Nandi.
I think definitely the options is here. So, like, lots of people have phones, but lots of people don't have smartphones. They might have feature phones. So definitely there's a lot of people who could be onboarded onto smartphones and begin to do micropayments and things like that. I also think the e-commerce
because for a while, so e-commerce has struggled in Nigeria. So we have had companies like Jumia, Konga, and they haven't really done that well. Consumers were reluctant to pay in advance. People would sometimes order from both of them, and whichever came first got paid. So I think now with this sort of COVID and lockdown and people not being able to move around as much, and just an awareness that people don't have to, get in a car and go places and get into, I mean, the traffic in Lagos is a nightmare. Don't have to do that. So I think these companies are going to have a definitely a second look in Jumia and Konga.
Okay.
Working from home is a massive, it's much more productive. I think there's much more productivity impact in a place like Lagos compared to London, for example, because obviously public transport is very poor here in Lagos. There's no underground, no trains, no monorails, anything like that. And so I was talking to a banker friend, and he said that they've worked from home since March, and all his staff are really happy with it.
Yeah.
So that's
I think. Jeffrey, what's your thoughts on this? We're talking about the last episode of this podcast. We talked about sort of congestion charging, new ways to pay for the roads. Do you see transport as being one of the, if not the most obvious kind of point for this kind of innovation? Because that's the sector I'm from, and I see it all the time. It's an obvious one for me, but where do you stand on that?
Well, we need an innovation that provides a better trade-off between time and cost. Public transportation takes a long time, and it's cheap, versus private car, taxi, or it's faster, and it's more expensive. So you have to come up with some type of innovation that does a better trade-off, a different trade-off between cost and time, than do the existing ones. Ride-sharing did not do that. It did the same thing with the taxis. The easiest thing to do is to use algorithms to provide better bus services. And it doesn't have to be a bus. It could be a van. It could be all kinds of things. There's all kinds of ways to get people from point A to point B faster and cheaper, I think, using algorithms. But it's we have to do it in a different way than we're doing it. We don't need another taxi service. We need a better bus service. We need a better small van service. And you could also think about the same thing with, I think that the scooters have been done wrong, because they just get thrown in there with cars and pedestrians, and you have to create a different space for them.
Yeah.
So in terms of transport, the regulator has to be involved. And we really need universities to step up and come up with some better ideas for how to do this.
It is an interesting Silicon Valley kind of axiom that no one seems to be interested in any technology which isn't standalone.
Yeah.
So if you think about, now I think Ford may be an exception here, because I think they've got a Ford F-150 coming out, which can be driverless on roads which are pre-equipped with some sort of special lane, okay? But if you think about the driverless car thing, it's a much easier problem to solve if you can allow infrastructure to be designed around it. Yeah, but the Silicon Valley kind of maverick thing assumes that you don't have a metal strip laid down the road, you don't have chips in signage or anything of that kind. It assumes that the car has to replicate the human driver as a standalone entity. Whereas actually, if there were cooperation between institutions and government and the car industry, you could produce something that was much more interesting. And by the way, I don't think it's entirely about speed, actually. I think it's about predictability of journey time. So that I think there's scope for quite slow pods, which basically just are Wi-Fi enabled, or there's 5G around anyway. And there was a pod manufacturer who contacted me, and I said, I've only got one suggestion for you. I don't know anything about your technology. Make sure it's got a desk in it. Okay. Like those old Rolls Royces, which have picnic tables in the back, so that you can use a laptop while you're in transit. Okay. Because actually, that's in many ways why the train, the Eurostar, wins over flying to Paris. It's the fact that you sit on your ass for 2 hours 50 and you can get on with other shit, whether it's entertaining yourself or productive work. Whereas when you travel by plane, it's the going from pillar to post, of check-in to security to baggage to the lounge to the gates to the boarding. That's the real pain. Similarly, I think, if you had a pod system which said, okay, you need to get to this place in Lagos, you need to leave now, it wouldn't matter if it were a bit slow. One of the things, I mean, if it's bad in London, imagine what it's like in Lagos. One of the things that's bad about London is that every journey requires you to leave a 30-minute buffer for possible delay, which wastes an inordinate amount of time, because you when you don't get stuck in traffic, you end up leaving too early and arriving too early.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So we talked about driverless cars. That's what I'm dealing with for some time. So what's everyone's theory on the future for driverless cars? We're looking at driverless car startups. There's coming out of the woodwork all over the place. But the major ones, the main ones, have still been around for some time. You're looking at companies like Peloton and Plus, who do autonomous trucking, that kind of thing. So autonomous goods trafficking. You're talking about companies that must make sure whether it's Peloton or Plus, one of those two. They do this thing with the butter run, where they drive from Pennsylvania to California with a truck full of butter. If that vehicle was driven by a human being, it would take 6 days. In driverless mode, it takes 2 days because there's no stopping. All it does is pull in, the truck pulls into a petrol station and the human, not driver, the human monitor fills up, back in, and the truck pulls away out of the petrol station. It does it in 2 days. It's that's also taken up a lot of traffic that would be normally be taken up in the air. That's air traffic, isn't it? But it's been used on the road. And once those vehicles can be electric, and maybe even solar powered, fantastic. But where's the next one coming from? Because we've got those companies already there. They're already doing that work. Like some colleagues of mine are already working in that sector and are pushing that really hard. Where's the next innovation going to come from? I'm going to start with Eric because you came up on the screen first. Yeah.
I would say we can't know, but what we can do is if we start to look at the data of where, especially, and this is where Jeffrey's work and Nigel's work can come in, why those transport startups have lost so much money. I mean, I know specifically, I knew Uber could never make money. Uber, Didi, Lyft, Bolt, they just can't make money until you've combined them with the road. Yeah. But there are other things which specifically because of this lockdown and because if we start to charge for roads, you'll find that people might want to use light rail systems, which suddenly change all the metrics. And I think that's a very important thing to look at. For example, London, you've got lots of options which you don't have in a place like Lagos. So in Lagos, you get a much better bang for your buck by laying down some infrastructure, which gives you an absolutely predictable journey time because there's nothing else in the way. In Wuppertal in Germany, they built a hanging railway over the river because there's nobody else going over the river, 8 meters up or wherever else, so you can never be delayed. So something like this, it will be very interesting to compare, not just some of the taxi hailing startups, which do nothing to the existing infrastructure except produce more congestion, to what would the returns likely be for something to do with light rail infrastructure? I think that could be very interesting because this narrative has got to change that the Silicon Valley BC pipeline is the only one. There has to be other ways to deploy some of that money. And I think this conversation that we're having may start that new narrative here. Because as Rory has said before, often at times to get people to accept something, you've just got to change the story in their head. And right now we've got this story that the only way you can do something is to be in Silicon Valley and have a startup with this smart guy. And, you've got a billion users who aren't paying money, but you're subsidizing everything. I think that's got to change. And I don't think those models will work in Africa or South America. There just isn't the hard skin to take all those losses that we do have in more developed capital markets.
Actually, there's a huge chunk of low-hanging fruit, which is a problem because of a coordination problem, which I think is, which is around the area of delivery. Essentially, I think Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales were slightly disappointing, weren't they? I mean, they went up 18%. I think there's a ceiling, and I think it's both an environmental and sustainable ceiling. It's a congestion ceiling and a psychological ceiling around the number of deliveries we can mentally cope with. Okay, right? So the psychological ceiling is that if you actually end up having everything delivered to your home, your front drive turns into a distribution hub. And before you know it, you'll be standing outside your house in a high-vis vest directing reversing vans, okay? Yeah. And actually, you know, if you think about it, Amazon has cracked the problem of how to sell 10 things to 10 people. Crack that. What it hasn't solved is the problem of how to sell 10 things to one person.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, that still remains, you know, that last mile question and the need for consolidation of delivery and even better still, locker delivery rather than delivery to the door. Because logistically, delivering to probably to have kind of walking distance locker availability to, let's say, 90% of the UK population. There's a Dutch startup which defines walking distance as the distance you can walk in your slippers, not in shoes. Okay. But you, okay, Holland's got the highest population density in Europe, so it's got a bit of an advantage there. But nonetheless, you could achieve that with maybe 25,000 lockers, no more than that. Huge difference between the difficulty of delivering to 25,000 lockers and delivering to 23 million homes. With the addition, by the way, that you can deliver to lockers at 4 o'clock in the morning and 11 o'clock at night. Whereas if somebody did that here, my neighbors would go bananas, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a huge opportunity there in somehow in delivery consolidation and just managing what you've ordered. Interesting, isn't it, that Shopify hasn't opened a storefront, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
But if Shopify teamed up with a delivery company and said, essentially, what we'll do is you can order from 27 shops, pay once, and get it delivered in one box. I imagine that would appeal in Lagos just as much as it does in London, by the way. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Namdi, you do that, don't you? You get your things grouped up in the UK and then sent over to Lagos, you're telling me.
So yeah. You've got one of those freight consolidating things where it's an importation service where you buy 10 things in the UK. When they've all arrived, you then put them in a box and they get flown to Lagos.
Yeah, yes, essentially a freight forwarder, that sort of thing. Yes, there's a warehouse in Dagenham or somewhere like that. And things go from Amazon and M&S and other places there. So, yeah, so that's quite a very useful service, especially in this time.
Actually, that opportunity sits. I mean, there are huge opportunities where there's a huge opportunity to improve the human condition, but no one can make the business case work. Probably because it's. I mean, email would be another one, by the way. I mean, I could sit down in a day and suggest 10 improvements to email. For example, it wouldn't necessarily. You know, the more people you send an email to, the longer it takes to arrive. Okay, yeah. Which would prevent stupid mass emails, essentially. You know, so it's email eugenics, basically. You know, you slow the reproduction rate of the least important messages. Okay, and I could come up with 10 suggestions like that with a bunch of people in a day, but they haven't been implemented because there's no incentive to do so.
Yeah.
I think we can show. I really think now, especially in that logistics and delivery. I know, Jeffrey, you've done incredible. Detailed research on categories. It would be interesting to compare how the performance of certain logistics and delivery companies have performed over the last 10-15 years. We can also have a parallel thing with Nigel's robo VC model to predict what they're likely to get. Okay. And then we can see what happens when we inject a new narrative for specifically this thing, because I went to a Transport Research Hub event where they were saying what you're just saying, Robbie. This was 2 years ago. They were saying that you should never try and deliver to houses. You can reduce van journeys by some like 80% by delivering to a locker service where everybody can walk to. So it would be interesting to compare on the sectoral analysis some of those things and to see. This is going back to front. This is saying, let's suggest something, let's plug it into a couple of models and see what's likely to happen, and then let's experiment and see what money we could get from it. I'd love to see what would happen.
There is an attempt in London called Delivering London, which is a consortium of organizations, including delivery organizations and retailers, which is trying to do this, and Transport for London, which of course owns the real estate in many cases. But that's interesting. I think what's happened now is that the remaining problems to be solved in tech aren't tech problems. And you've got a load of technologists who want to solve tech problems because that's where they derive their status and that's where their specialism lies. I think the remaining problems are actually marketing problems and coordination problems.
Yeah.
And actually, the problem is we've got the wrong mindset, which is a lot of people who want to show off their ability in tech. And actually, it's a psychological. I mean, I think solar panels are now a marketing problem. It's not a problem of how you make the panels more efficient. It's how do you get the bastards to put the things on the roof. Right. OK. You know, and I was saying to someone this morning, I said, look, 20% of this problem will be solved if you can persuade John Lewis to sell. This is a very British example. So Nigel, Jeffrey, and you'll understand. Andy and Eric will understand. Yeah. If John Lewis starts selling solar panels and installing them, 20% of that problem solved because people go, oh, it's OK now. It's a normal thing to do. Yeah. Whereas at the moment, I've got to get in touch with some guy who starts talking about like kilowatt hours and, you know, and you know. I mean, it's a bit like buying an electric car, if you think about it. The language is all around. If you haven't got a degree in electrical engineering, you know, only recently have they started coming up with the vocabulary that's necessary for ordinary humans to understand what the hell's going on. Yeah. And, you know, I genuinely see that. I think the opportunity to solve marketing problems with a bit of tech is bigger than the opportunity to solve tech problems with tech.
Got it. Yeah. Nigel, I'm going to come to you. You're Nigel's, for those of you listening, Nigel's not on screen. And it's, I don't want to elude him because I can't see him. So interestingly, I was discussing, again, autonomous trucks the other day. And we talked about the idea of logistics companies, freight companies, traveling from, let's say, Perth to Canberra. Mm. And it's basically one road across the middle of Australia for thousands of miles. So there's a lot more to it than that. But there was a huge great stretch of highway that's perfect for autonomous vehicles.
They're actually running tests here that there's a big movement in Australia for smart cities, and a number of the Asian electronic companies and auto companies are down here running their smart car tests programs down here. Now, the reality is that these vehicles work well in a controlled environment, but as soon as you start to introduce Australian wildlife, things like kangaroos and wombats and emus, then the whole thing really grinds to a halt very, very quickly. I know from some of the tests done locally in Sydney, the cars struggle to determine the difference between a wombat and a rock in the middle of the road, sort of thing. And so the stories which are emerging from these tests are starting to become a little bit legendary around the town. I think the challenge for the smart vehicle movement essentially is tied very closely to the smart cities movement.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're actually one of the same challenge. And so I think the smart cities movement is about putting in the infrastructure which allows you to measure, monitor, and manage your city in real time using sensors, data, and obviously tech.
Yeah.
Now obviously logistics and cars are just one aspect of that unified model or that unified theory of cities. In terms of the point-to-point between Melbourne and Sydney or Melbourne and Perth, that's probably a very different city, a very different challenge. That obviously you have to resolve the smart cities challenge before you can start resolving smart country.
Yes, yeah, good point.
And so it comes down to degrees that the smart cities movement in reality is actually a little more than smart tech suburbs. What you have at the moment is local council jurisdiction lobbying hard to create localised smart city projects, which essentially are about driving up real estate.
People have completely underestimated the difficulties of doing these driverless vehicles. Where they're doing these tests in areas in not downtown, not the most congested areas, but in less congested areas, and all in good weather.
Mm.
You know, it's all these sunny places, no rain, no snow, no fog. A lot of the world has very bad weather. And that bad weather happens at least 6-9 months of the year. And you can't have these driverless vehicles only working, only operating during good weather. And if you only have them operating in a suburb where maybe the traffic isn't bad as in the downtown, then it's going to take a very long time for this diffusion to occur. I think everyone's putting a good face on it, like, oh, you know, trying to solve the easiest problem first, which makes sense, but they're not realizing that this is going to take a lot longer than people think.
You might argue, which I would a bit, which is that you don't have to solve 100% of the problem, because the only time, you know, broadly speaking, one thing to remember is people enjoy driving to an extent, okay, under the right conditions. And long motorway drives, if you automate those or semi-automate them, and you also automate being stuck in traffic, you take away a significant element of the pain. One of the things I noticed, which did surprise me, is that adaptive cruise control.
Yeah. But the problem is people find the opposite. They find that when you automate most of the functions, people's attention goes away, and then they're more likely to get in an accident.
Yep. I agree. It's interesting. So the most important thing, I think, with autonomous vehicle technology is accident prevention rather than autonomous driving. Because I think that can be quite significant, can't it? But then people drive more dangerously because they assume their car will pick up the slack? You know,
the goal should be to reduce the distances between cars so that you can have more vehicles traveling fast on a highway or on roads than they do now. That is the key issue. It's not really getting rid of the driver. It's allowing cars, a transportation system to operate for more cars to move per time.
I mean, technically, you wouldn't need junctions. You could have cars at right angles crisscrossing at 70 miles an hour. Yeah. I think it's fair to say that most people would find that experience absolutely goddamn terrifying. But that is technically possible, certainly.
Yeah. But that's interesting. You talk about what you're talking about there, Jeffrey, is platooning, where that's been going on for 20 years. That's 1999 in the Brenner Pass, a mountain road between that joins Italy to Austria. There was the first truck platooning experiments, with trucks that follow each other. Now, using complicated sort of communications. In those days, it was a lot less technical, but that was happening 20 years ago. So
I have to admit, I do a bit of platooning.
But it's highways where they're heavily congested highways.
Yes,
that where there's bumper to bumper. That's where we want to be able to increase the amount of the movement of the vehicles. And that's that. So you want to put the intelligence in the road, not in the car.
Or not. The alternative is, and I think we have to discuss this, which is you just get fewer people. A large amount of business travel pre-COVID was what I call, it was performative. And it was done because it was a social norm. It was a convention. There was no need to fly to Frankfurt for a day to meet three people and fly back again, almost ever. Okay. Maybe to meet them for the first time. Okay. But one of the other questions is that, this is why I talk about goods a lot, people quite like travel. They certainly like traveling for leisure, but generally they don't enjoy moving about that much, I would argue. And they do it for very specific purposes. I think that video calling can supplant a very large amount of human transportation. And it'll be interesting to see. It's certainly business travel. Robert Crandall of American Airlines says, don't expect business travel to revert to the levels before COVID because it's never going to come back. And I think he's right, fundamentally there.
Do you think these technology exhibitions will come back like they used to be?
Well, those sort of huge conventions.
Conferences, yeah, huge conventions.
I think they'll be hybrid. And I think it's a really interesting question. I agree with you. They'll be hybrid because, weirdly, to hold a business conference where you don't have the live stream will make you, post-COVID, seem like the Freemasons or the Illuminati. You know, it'll look kind of secretive and weird, okay? You know, what you're having a conference in a room in London and you're not going to actually make it available online, that's going to make you look a bit creepy, okay? And second, so I think you'll, the other thing I think you'll probably see is a bit of a winner takes all effect, and things like that will happen. And there will be, there'll be hybrid, there'll be a physical component to it. Maybe people pay, it's a bit like the Super Bowl, people pay a huge amount to attend in person and less to watch it remotely. But I think that will happen. I don't think you'll have that business of, maybe in an industry, it was happening anyway, to be honest, the concentration in fewer, larger events. But I do genuinely think that if you think about the bizarre behavior of business before COVID, which was you had these two extremes. You either basically typed and sent people things, or you shared a spreadsheet, or you went to the whole extreme of getting into a taxi or an aircraft and seeing them in person. And there was no intermediate form of communication. That was weird, undoubtedly. I think the norms changed, would be my view, that, you know, it, saying I'm terribly sorry, I can't travel to Frankfurt, but I would talk to you on video. A year ago, that made you look like a weirdo. And now that's been established as a perfectly normal behavior.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of business travel, as I said on a previous podcast, it's like dressing for dinner in the 19th century. Everybody did it because everybody else did.
Yeah. No, you're right. So we're going to come to the end of our podcast. In fact, it's a business podcast. I'm talking about IPOs. We've mentioned the Illuminati, which I think is that's great. Nobody else does this. This is what you get when you listen to the new. So I'm going to come to all of you and ask one stupid kind of question, really. But I'm going to ask it anyway. Is that if you were going to be investing in a startup, a new startup, what sector would you be looking at as the best way of making, not necessarily a quick buck, but what's next? Got a lot of interesting stuff going on. You're looking at fintech, you're looking at autonomous vehicles, you're looking at, I personally, we're looking at something like digital healthcare, smart health, especially now. I'm a type 1 diabetic. I have, if this was the TV and not the radio, I could show you my inbuilt sensor. I've got a blood sugar sensor in my arm, and I use my smartphone with an app, and I click on it and I press it, and it tells me my blood sugar now, and it tells me what it's going to be the next hour's time, and it tells me the last 24 hours, I can look at the last month, the last 6 months, and then I can contact. So if my blood sugar is particularly high, I can then put a note on into the app and put, why is my sugar high? Send that, and my diabetic specialist will contact me within an hour and say, don't worry, it's just an anomaly or whatever. Or were you under pressure? Have you been drinking? No, and no. I think that's that stuff, especially now when people can't get out, is fascinating. So what do you think? I'm going to start with Jeffrey. I'm going to go in order that I can see you all. Jeffrey.
I'm very optimistic about plant-based meat. I think also lab-based meat. I think that the trends towards vegetarianism is going to push people away from eating meat and more towards lab-based meat or plant-based meat. Also, the climate change aspect of this. Meat has a lot of impact on carbon emissions and land usage and things like that. So I'm very optimistic about plant-based meat, lab-based meat.
Okay, nothing. Nandi?
Yeah. Looking at investing in Nigeria, I'll be looking at agri-tech. So starting from powering up farms, mechanization, processing using drones, drone cameras, and all that kind of stuff. I think there's a huge opportunity in that space. Yeah.
Okay, interesting you mentioned that, because there's a company in Russia, I think I mentioned it before, called Cognitive Technologies, who have developed the world's first AI-powered autonomous combine harvester.
Ooh.
Very good. So maybe I'll get in touch with them, because
there's also the small tractor company in the UK, which is very interesting, which is it's kind of micro macro farming.
Right.
In other words, rather than spraying a whole field with pesticides, the little thing just bustles around and goes, ooh, look, there's a little bit of, you know, whatever weird crop disease there is, and it simply sprays where necessary. So kind of what you might call fractal farming, I think, is really interesting.
Okay. Right. That's your one then. Yeah. You've had yours now.
Okay.
You've had your go. Eric?
I think designed materials is a very, very important place. We saw a little bit of this, and it'd be interesting. We can talk about this offline later. I don't know if the graphene thing, I think I saw a post you said, Jeffrey, that graphene was touted as a new super material, but here we are some years later, and we haven't really seen any very specific uses. And so that looks like another bubble made up. But there are things, there's a company called CMR, which makes magnets with specific properties, like a magnet which might repel at a certain distance or attract at a different distance. It's bizarre. But these things can give you all sorts of things, like magnetic cogs, for example. So you can transmit torque through a solid thing. And I think that's a huge win. So I think design materials are going to be one of the more important areas to invest in, which we're not seeing any real narrative on just yet.
Okay, excellent. Nigel?
Look, I think it's an interesting time. I'd like to think we're actually evolving beyond just disrupting paper, which we seem to have been doing for the last 50 years. I suspect not. I suspect, as in the last 30 years, if you're really looking to make money, then you would be banking on financialization. And the tech level is actually redundant. It's actually how financial markets package this stuff up and pretend that it is innovation and it is bright, shiny and new. Because at the end of the day, that's where the money's made. I think if you're actually looking for the moonshots, then I think essentially there's three. One is space exploration. Two is smart cities. And three is probably smart agriculture. But yeah, I think the reality is I hope that we're actually turning a corner, because I think the last 20 years have actually been a black hole for innovation. I think that the problem goes back to the Netscape browser, which in reality took information technology back to the early 80s. Essentially, all we did was repackage WordStar and call it bright, shiny and new. Yeah. And we seem to have been doing that for the last 20 years, 30 years. I get the feeling there's a generation emerging which is actually moving beyond that. That they're starting to think about hardware again. So the Internet of Things, smart cities, you're seeing a lot of buzz around that. I think that's great.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
But if you're trying to make money, then financialization, in reality, I think it'll be just business as usual.
Yes, I feel bad for cutting you off, or you kind of had another go. But please do come up with your own suggestion. I'm sorry, I feel bad.
No. My only other one would be really expensive home video conferencing hardware for business people to display status some other way. they haven't got their frequent flyer gold cards anymore. So I think someone like Leica could set up some spectacularly elaborate home video conferencing studio, and you could sell them at £1,000 a pop pretty easily.
I think the future of that's going to be VR, isn't it? It'll be some sort of virtual reality
or goggle-based,
which goes well beyond that. I mean, VR is a technology which has been coming for, 30 years and still looks like it's on the horizon. It's hard to know whether it'll actually hit that cusp and actually take off. I mean, if you look back, the real innovation of the last 30 years has actually been in the movies. You know, there's a reason we've got Game of Thrones today and Terminator and all that other stuff which emerged. The real innovation has actually happened in entertainment.
Yeah, that is very true. I mean, I guess Rory's point, then this would be only Zoom, wouldn't it? And the same way my kids used to go to a private school, and I was surrounded by very wealthy people who used to go to Barbados for half term. And whenever they asked me, well, where are you going for half term? And they're, or are you going for the summer? I'd be going to only Cornwall or only Scotland or only Norway. And I think I used to refer to all countries as only wherever, just because I found it amusing, helped me feel better about myself. This would be only Zoom in Rory's world, wouldn't it? only go to webinar. Other systems are available. But status affirmed video conferencing software. I like it. That's a great way to end, Rory. Thank you.
Cities. Maybe we need to be focusing on smart suburbs because we confuse the numbers. So we always say that, you know, 8 million people live in London, for example, and we say that, you know, 70% of people in the world will live in these huge megacities.
Yep.
But most of those people don't actually live in the city, well, particularly true in Australia, of course, Nigel, you know, they don't actually live in the city, okay? They live somewhere around it. And I think possibly, you know, particularly if there's a bit of a shift in terms of working patterns, we need to think suburban, which is a desperately unfashionable thing to do. But ultimately, what people need to do is they need to live within reach of a megacity for the opportunities it provides, simply what Nassim Taleb calls kind of the upside opportunities. OK, so we need to be within access of one. But how many people actually want to live right in the middle of one is another question.
Mm.
That's a good point. Right, and on that note, we shall end. Thank you, gentlemen. That's fascinating. Yeah. So, Jeffrey, Nandi, Eric, Rory, Nigel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We've all got busy lives, and I appreciate you giving an hour. Sorry for the confusion earlier on. So this has been great. So join us again very shortly for another confusingly numbered and lettered podcast. We've got to get sorted, Eric.
I'm sorry.
This is 3A. We're going to do 3B. This was supposed to be 7. I'm not quite sure. We are at 6s and 7s.
I'll make a canonical definitiveness.
I think a canonical one was lovely. Thank you very much indeed. So, on behalf of everyone who's listening, thank you all for your time, gentlemen. It's been fantastic. And hopefully you'll join us again very soon on the new. I'm Kevin Burris. Thank you and goodbye.